We have read about the divine teacher and the human disciple. The divine teacher is Shri Krishna, who is the immanent divine seated in the heart of all creatures. He is always available and accessible to us. And if we do not receive the guidance, it's because we have not turned to him. So he is the guide, but we have given the reins of the chariot of our life to the ego. And therefore, he is still there, but he is seated on the chariot incognito. He is there, but he believes in freedom, and we have to hand over the reins, make a conscious choice that you have to be the driver of our life. And he'll be very happy to do that. He's only waiting for the human soul to evolve and turn, reach that point where it is ready to hand over the reins to the divine. But ordinarily, this is not the case, and therefore Krishna does not appear to us in the sense that he doesn't have to appear to us the way he appeared to Arjuna, but as the inner prompter and guide. So, this discovery, this turning towards Krishna is the moment that changes everything for Arjuna, and so it can change for us. And this moment can come either because of a natural evolution in our life. We reach a point where we find the insufficiency of the intellect in the way we understand and organize our life, and then we can turn to the divine. Or it may come to us through a moment of crisis. That's what we see in the life of Arjun, the human disciple. There is a moment of crisis in which he realizes the inadequacy of all that he has known, all that he has understood, and the crisis of a very practical as well as ethical nature. So he does what we should do but do not do is hand over the reins to Krishna and ask him for guidance. Ask him that, I don't know how to govern my life. But ordinarily in life, we do not find that happening. There is one set of humanity which believes it knows, or it doesn't care for knowledge. It is pushed into action by impulse, instinct, desires, ego, ambition. And it doesn't want any other higher truth. And it has no conflict, so to say. But the lack of conflict is not because it is a very evolved humanity. The lack of conflict is because it believes that whatever way I am leading my life, that is the way we should lead it. So Duryodhan and his cohorts represent that kind of humanity. On the other hand, there are those who have thought about life and have formed their own personal system of ethics and values. This is the other extreme. Duryodhan is one extreme where he is driven by ambition and he believes it's cool to be driven by ambition. It's natural to be driven by desires. And hence he doesn't seek any guidance. And these are others who have thought about things, who have read books, who have formed their own personal values based on either the values of the times they live in or through their own inner reflection, they have arrived at some kind of understanding about life. And they believe that they know, and therefore they don't feel the necessity to know further, to turn to the divine for a greater guidance. So these are the moralists or people who believe they know, and again they miss out on the great teaching. Among them we see men like Yudhishthir, Vidur, Bhishma. So again the Gita is not for this. It does not come. Neither Krishna nor the Gita comes to them. But there is a layer of humanity, and I believe most of us, who go through a moment when all our values, they seem to collapse. They don't help us. They don't guide us. And at that point of time, when we don't know what we should do, and that point of time, if we turn to the divine who is within our hearts, then the Gita unfolds. So Gita is at once a book which could be read and understood through the slokas, but the Gita is also the song of the divine. Gita means song. Gita. So the beauty is, our life should become, if I have to put it in a little poetic way, our life should become a song of the divine, moved by the rhythm of the divine. But this Gita, which is and closed within our heart opens only when we realize the self insufficiency or the insufficiency of the human intellect, moral principles that have guided us so long, and then we turn to the divine asking him for guidance. So that moment has come in Arjuna's life, and what has the teacher to say to him would apply to all of us who thus seek such a guidance. So the interesting part is there are, because Gita is a very wide scripture, Catholic scripture, so there is a tendency for one-sided interpretations of the Gita, and Sri Aurobindo cautions us against it. It is equally true and much more true of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, because Sri Aurobindo and the mother, as we know, are much, much more wide. You pick up a letter and it would mean one thing, and you will see exactly, seemingly opposite in another letter. And Sri Aurobindo says that. He says, for example, that to somebody who sleeps less, eats less, I may write, sleep more, eat more. But to someone who's spending his life in eating and sleeping, I would say eat less, sleep less. So with Sri Aurobindo and the mother, it is much more, because the literature is very vast. It had to be vast because it has to cater to all kinds and layers of humanity. But whenever we have a vast Catholic scripture, the problem is that it can be interpreted in different ways. So there are some who interpret the Gita as a scripture which ultimately speaks of superiority of knowledge over action. And they will quote verses from the Gita. Some who even say that the Gita teaches sannyas, because it speaks about karma sannyas. So we can just imagine, whereas the whole problem of Arjuna is that I don't want to take sannyas. I want to take sannyas, and Krishna bids him to. And these two are still can be addressed. There are some who say that Gita is simply a doctrine of devotion. So Gita is all of these, but much more than these. And then there is the modern mind which interprets Gita, meaning thereby you do duty indifferent to everything else. You have to do a duty, you must do your duty regardless of success or failure, because nishkam karma. And therefore they pick up that aspect of the Gita, that without desire for fruits you must do your duty. But duty is a very ambiguous thing. For example, it is the duty of the Sri Aurobindo speaks about it in great detail. It is the duty of the judge to send the criminal to the gallows. But what if there is an internal shift in him? He begins to believe that I should not be doing it. So what should he do? Should he follow the duty which is according to whatever guidelines of law are there? Should he leave the field and go away, or should he follow the inner awakening that is taking place within him? So duty itself, for example, Buddha's duty was to look after his wife and the kingdom and the child. But he is moved by a higher impulse that there is suffering humanity and he wants to find a cure. So should Buddha be going back and, you know, looking after the kingdom as a king and the family, or Buddha should follow this inner trail? So in other words, there are three or four principles of action which human beings follow. One is the law of the brute. They are moved by impulse and they take it to be the right thing to do, and they do it. As simple as that. They live for themselves, for their extremely selfish, egoistic needs. They are driven by desire and they act according to that. Obviously, it would create chaos in a society which live where each one lives only for himself. So therefore, in all societies, there comes a way to regulate this tendency. We see when we go to primitive societies, that's how it was. Whoever is mighty, might is right. So survival of the fittest. This is how primitive societies were, because they are closer to animal kind. And this primitive has nothing to do with what looks outward, because still the primitive and the caveman dwells within us. Wherever in a society people live for whatever I feel like I will do, you are still living in a primitive society. Wherever people live for satisfaction of desires, they are still in a primitive society. But as society, at least a few people in society begin to awaken to the necessity to organize life, to create some kind of order and harmony. So they bring in law, constitution, some kind of rules and regulations which may be either dependent on the secular fabric of society where people there think that this is how it should be. And human beings should govern their life according to these social and legal, whatever conduct is there. Or in religious society, there are religious do's and don'ts. So this is the second layer of humanity where you still fulfill your desires, but you have to do it within the framework provided by the society. And if you go outside that framework, the society stops supporting you. So if you need this collectivity to engage with you, you have to give to the collectivity some kind of allegiance, some kind of obedience. This is the second type. This is what we see last few hundred years mankind has been trying. Then because no social custom, duty, no religious code of conduct can be perfect, therefore from this second layer there are those who revolt. They say, no, this does not answer all my queries. So then in this third layer you will see people who begin to develop individual ethics. So individual ethics is, well, socially something may be wrong, but my individual ethics tells me that it is the right thing to do. Therefore I should do it, not because society or religion prescribes it. Maybe it even prescribes it, but my individual ethics says that it is the right thing to do. Say for example, somebody who comes, and as the typical example is a thief who comes and hides in your house and he's seeking help and you have granted that I'll help you. Now if the police comes looking for the thief, what are you going to do? Now legally you are duty bound to inform, but maybe morally you may think otherwise because you have come to know while sitting with the thief that probably he stole a loaf of bread because he was hungry. So in such a situation, we see a dilemma between the social and the legal framework and your personal ethics, your personal values. So here comes that third layer of people who, they are not individualistic the way it is normally understood, that I will do whatever I feel like. But they've evolved a greater ethical sense from within them. And then beyond them, but sometimes this also fails. And when this fails, collapses, because your personal ethics, values, society, religion, doctrine, they are not able to guide you. Because there is a clash. And that clash may be either in certain personal values which I cherish and the collective expectations from you. And neither, or sometimes there could be two personal values which are at conflict with each other. You have to look after your family in normal circumstances. And at the same time, you have to think about the community at large. Now, you may be caught, take for example that if your own child is into drugs, now the natural impulse is that you should safeguard him, try your best to help him. But on the other hand, he is not only taking drugs, peddling drugs. So what do you do in such a situation? Because society is getting affected because of this boy. So most people will not know what to do. One impulse would be, no, we should safeguard. After all, my child, whatever I do, I will try. On the other hand, there would be other extreme where people will say, doesn't matter, I'll send him to the, let law take its course. Both are difficult choices. At such a moment, what do I do? So that's when, if we turn to the divine, we will be guided. What that guidance will be, we will see through the chapters. So Gita is a book of not just practical action. It is not teaching simply that do your duties. That's how people will say, this is my duty and therefore I will do it, indifferent to the results. And Shubhendu says, if that's all the Gita has to teach, then we should throw the book out from the windows of spiritual literature. Such a mighty teaching, only to teachers, do your duties. You don't need a book of guidance to say that. Most awakened people will do it. Anyways, most people who have developed some kind of even a rudimentary conscience will say, no, this is my duty, I should do it. So the Gita is teaching us much more. Second is, while it is true that Gita is a guide to how to act and live in the world, its goal is through action to arrive at God realization. It is a yoga. It is not teaching us how to navigate through life. And there are many modern books which have come nowadays in the name of the Gita. And Shobindu says they have cut God away, because to speak of God, your book won't sell. If the moment you bring in God in a book based on practical Gita in everyday life, and you remove God. If you put in God, then most people will not buy. They'll say, what is God? What has God got to do with all this? As I was sharing this experience in Mumbai, somebody wanted to talk about Krishna. And the school said that, Krishna is something to do with religion. Therefore, we don't accept that. So to sell a book, to sell a teaching, people put it in very nice packages. But that's not the Gita. It's okay, whatever people want to do, but that's not the Gita. The Gita is a path, and a very wide path. And the path is not just to teach us how to act, but through action to arrive at God realization. And if we cut that aspect from the Gita, then it is no more Gita, but our own interpretation. So this is the background with which Shobindo takes us. We can enter the chapter on the core of the teaching. This is page 29. So we have touched upon some of the things, and I'll come to page. Okay, I'll just read a couple of sentences. On page 28, second para. Thus, there are those who make the Gita teach not works at all, but a discipline of preparation for renouncing life and works. There are such teachings. We have Shankaracharyas and people who interpret like that. They say, yes, you need to do works, but it is a karma kanda. What kind of works? Works which are of a religious nature. And these works will help you to prepare ultimately for an afterlife or for moksha. So Shobindu says, there are those who say that the indifferent performance of prescribed actions prescribed by whom? By religion. Or of whatever task may be ready to the hands, becomes the means, the discipline, the final renunciation of life and works is the sole real object. So what are these? These are the traditional works that in every Indian family, for example, it was do the homam, do the daily prayer, ritual worship, and then you go for work. Whatever work you are doing, you should do it conscientiously. Why? Because at the end, ultimately, you have to renounce life and works and enter into moksha. So this or in some heaven beyond. And Shobindu says that people justify it by taking up certain citations from the Gita. The next page, paragraph begins, others again speak of the Gita as if the doctrine of devotion were its whole teaching, and put in the background its monistic elements and the high place it gives to quietistic emergence in the one self of all. So on one side we have the Shankaracharya type of interpretation of the Gita, where it is regarded as the doctrine where works are only to prepare yourself for moksha. On the other side we have the interpretation of the Krishna consciousness movement. So for them, Gita is primarily, they bring out the devotional element. And so therefore, they monkhood, monastery, whereas the Gita is about life, about engaging with action. And what action? A gory action. So Gita will never ask a human being to turn away from life and action. It will say, action is the means given to you. And through action, you can realize God. You don't have to just turn away and only pick up a mridangam and kartal and say Krishna, 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 Krishna. If you feel impelled, you can do it. But that's not what the Gita is teaching. That's what he is telling us. But again, you can pick up from the Gita passages which emphasize devotion and again prove the point. So he's saying that these are the two interpretations. But at the present day, the next para, since in fact the modern mind began to recognize and deal at all with the Gita, the tendency is to subordinate the elements of knowledge and devotion, knowledge by that mokshavadi, knowledge in the sense self, and the other part is devotion, which we see in the bhakti movements. to take advantage of its continual insistence on action and to find in it a scripture of the Karma Yoga, a light leading us on the path of action, a gospel of works. Undoubtedly, the Gita is a gospel of works, but of works which culminate in knowledge, that is, in spiritual realization and quietude, and of works motivated by devotion, that is, a conscious surrender of one's whole self, first into the hands and then into the being of the Supreme. It's so beautiful. Into the hands, meaning thereby you become an instrument. You become a tool in the hands of the Divine. And then into the to the Supreme means now all your being, whichever way he wants to take you, is given to him. So he says, this is it. And not at all of works as they are understood by the modern mind, not at all an action dictated by egoistic and altruistic, by personal, social, humanitarian motives, principles, ideas. That's how we see many of the modern interpretations of the Gita. And you'll find such books in plenty. You'll find it even in Shabda book like that. You know, you are in an office and how you are going to, in the light of the Gita. But it's not light of the Gita. You are simply saying that, you know, if you perform Nishkam Karma, what are the advantages? Logically, Nishkam Karma is the best thing to do. All this will say. But essentially, the man is the same. It is not leading you to path of God realization. And that's what the Gita will tell us. So what is that? We are told continually by many authoritative voices that the Gita, opposing in this the ordinary ascetic and quietistic tendency of Indian thought and spirituality, proclaims with no uncertain sound the gospel of human action, that you must act. And therefore, what people think? The ideal of disinterested performance of social duties, nay, even it would seem the quiet modern ideal of social service. I have heard once, I won't name, but there was a lecture here only in Oroville. Somebody had, it came on the YouTube. And the person, very well qualified person, was obviously read the scriptures a little bit. So they asked, what is Oroville doing ultimately for ordinary humanity? So the person was saying that, I have seen spiritual movement where people are doing philanthropy. He didn't use the word philanthropy. They are doing social service. They are uplifting those who are in need. What is Oroville doing? People ask the same thing about ashram. That there are no free hospitals. You are not treating sick people out. So what kind of a gospel it is? What are people doing? And if you tell them we are trying to change ourselves, then they say, but you don't seem to be changing. That's of course a different story altogether, because you are looking at the wrong place and you have preconceived ideas of what changes. But nevertheless, this is how also the Gita is being interpreted, that we have the Gita, you should do social duties, philanthropies. You should be moved by these kind of ideas which nowadays you see in which all world is engaged. Now, if that is the kind of thing we have to do, then the Gita is not really required. Already many human beings are doing that kind of stuff. We see this movement which came later on in even Sri Ramakrishna Mission. Feeding the poor, helping the needy. These are nice things, but they are not yoga. These may be even necessary in a certain society, and there are people who are inspired to do this. And they should do this. Because they are inspired, but they should not be under the illusion that they have taken up yoga, or they are on a path, spiritual path, or this will lead them to God realization. In all likelihood, this will only aggrandize the ego. Oh, I am doing this great thing. Oh, I am doing that great thing. I am involved in so many projects. I am running an NGO which is looking after trees. I am running an NGO which is looking after child welfare and 100 schemes. There are people who are doing it. And they have their place again. But that is not the Gita. And that is not yoga. And Sri Aurobindo says it in very strong words. To all this, and he has used words, egoistic and altruistic, personal, social, humanitarian motives, principles, ideals. Disinterest, the ideal of disinterested performance of social duties. I am doing it and I am not charging you money. I am helping the poor children. All right, do it. But it's not Gita. So we can imagine. Nay, even it would seem the quite modern ideal of social service. Every Sunday I go and feed the poor. And for the next 6 days, their life is miserable. because, you know, they're quite adjusted to a way of life and food, and now suddenly they are waiting for the Sunday, and the next 6 days they cannot enjoy whatever they're getting. And then Sri Aurobindo says, to all this I can only reply that very patently and even on the very surface of it, the Gita does nothing of the kind. And who is saying this? Sri Aurobindo. Not only had he realized the Gita, he had realized Vasudeva, the teacher of the Gita. So he's a yogi of yogis who is telling us this, who knew Sanskrit backward forward. And he knew the Gita, he had lived the Gita, and much more. So it is not a human being who is saying this. That this is a modern misreading, a reading of the modern mind into an ancient book of the present day European or Europeanized intellect, because that's how many of us growing up in, you know, schools have developed that kind of westernized intellect, into a thoroughly antique, a thoroughly oriental and Indian teaching. That which the Gita teaches is not a human but a divine action. None of the human motives, even the seemingly highest, humanitarian, philanthropy, none of these, social service, they're human motives. So it is not human action but a divine action. Divine action means impelled by a divine motive. Not the performance of social duties, but the abandonment of all other standards of duty or conduct for a selfless performance of the divine will. Selfless performance, but of what? Abandoning all other standards and only stay with the divine will. And if we do not know it, we should try to find it. That's that the Gita will teaches us how. Working through a nature, not social service, but the action of the best, the God-possessed, the master men done impersonally for the sake of the world and as a sacrifice to him who stands behind man and nature. So this is not a sacrifice to the ego or to society, but a sacrifice to the divine within man and the divine in the world. In other words, the Gita is not a book of practical ethics, but of the spiritual life. And then he says that what is the problem with the modern mind? Few lines below. It has got rid of God or kept him only for Sunday use and erected in his place man as its deity and society as its visible idol. So even people say, what is the use of such a thing to man? How are we going to benefit when the supermind manifested and people got to know? So people came all the way from some far off place. And they reached at night. They wanted Mother Darshan. Why? Because we have come from so far. Mother said, why? And then they said, they want to know what will be the, what, how we will benefit from the supermind. And the mother said, benefit? What have they done to benefit? It's the same business mentality. We want to benefit. I said, no, no, mother, they are asking. They have taken the trouble of coming. So, because they have come all the way, they are ready. What have they done for the divine? So, when she started saying this, she said, Mother, still we have to tell them something. So, mother says, tell them. They will get a few blows on the nose. Mother's words. Why? Because obviously it is truth consciousness. You live by falsehood, you will get a blow. And when the divine says, blow on the nose, you can imagine what it means, multiplied with 100 times. So this idea that this is for me, to benefit me, I've heard this even in the context of Auroville. Sorry to say, Auroville is for humanity. Auroville is to manifest the divine. Human is the instrument. So if you forget this one little thing, everything goes topsy-turvy. And so she says that you have to become ready, otherwise, even she speaks about the ashram context. She says, because there is freedom, people have taken it for licentiousness. Because everything is provided, everybody has become lazy. So she says, this is not what freedom is meant for. You have the freedom so that instead of bothering about other things, you have been provided with basic necessities. You can seek the divine and manifest him in life. This is the whole purpose of freedom and provision of things. Not to enjoy life and say, okay, just as we are leading life anywhere. So he says very clearly, it's the action of the best. Who is the best according to Gita? Not experts in this field or that field. The God-possessed, the master men. This is what is called a Shrestha or Aryan in the Gita. And next page, 32. Arjun is called upon, third line from above, Arjun is called upon to live according to the highest ideals of his age and the prevailing culture, but with knowledge, with understanding of that which lay behind, and not as ordinary men with a following of the merely outward law and rule. But the point here is that the modern mind has exiled from its practical motive power the two essential things, God or the eternal, and spirituality or the God state, which are the master conceptions of the Gita. So this is what we hear very often. I have heard it and it sounded very strange. No, we don't. I have heard it in another context. What mother? No, mother is not required anymore. That is religion. I have heard these things. And what is required? Human ego, its satisfaction. So you can imagine. So when it is said that no religion, it does not mean that love for God is banished. It simply means religion in the sense ritualistic religion, where one way of life is imposed upon everybody. Everybody has a kind of religion in the way of connecting with the divine. Love for God cannot be removed. It's a path. The Gita teaches, Sri Aurobindo teaches, surrender, love of the divine, everything. But you need not have fixed symbol. Each one has his own symbol, his own way of connecting with the divine. That's fine. But connecting with the divine is important. When you remove the symbol along with connecting with the divine, then you are throwing the baby with the bathwater. That I'll not have any puja. And that too should not be like a rule. Those who want to use a symbol, they should be happy to use a symbol. We have so many places filled with Mother and Sri Aurobindo's photograph. Well, people connect. I connect so much better. So we have to understand this difference is very subtle. Someone came to my room and a group of students, obviously this modern mind student, they saw Mother and Sri Aurobindo's photograph everywhere. He said, "Sir, why are you having Mother and Sri Aurobindo's photograph everywhere?" I said, "What's your problem?" "It's my choice." So he said, they have this idea that if you put a photograph, means you are this or that. I said, "Yes, that's my choice. I don't tell you ki you should have or not have. For all you know, you can put a black stone and worship it. It's your problem. I have no problem about it. As long as you don't have a problem about how I approach. I may have an idol of Lord Ganesha and worship it. Why? Because Ganesha represents to me the divine. Or I may have Hanuman and feel that this might connect to the divine. As long as I don't impose or try to, you know, convert everybody." This is where the problem of religion lies. It becomes like an ideology, a way of converting everybody to their own belief system. That's where the problem is. But connecting with God, arriving at God's state through whatever means you may. If you don't want, don't use anything. You have your own inner connect. That's the best. But mankind may need, somebody may need that outer connect. It's to each one. So this is where says the God state and God or the eternal, which are the master conceptions of the Gita. It lives in humanity only, and the Gita would have us live in God. Modern mind wants to live in human. Human is the God. State is the God. Convention is the God. Rule book is the God. Constitution is the God. Law is the legal framework is the God. But it says no. You have to live in God within. That's why I often say this, that if you believe in legal redressal or remedy for problems, you are far from spiritual life. Because that means you are still falling back upon human ways. Whereas the true way is to discover within, turn to the divine, offer your action to God, and then be moved by that, and nishkam bhava. Do it whether it's up to the divine to grant it or not grant it, or when to grant it. But you have to continue doing it, but in a state of God state, not in a human state. So Gita would want us to live in God. Though for the world in God, in its life, heart and intellect only, and the Gita would have us live in the spirit, in the mutable being who is all creatures. After every semicolon, it's like world would want us to live in the mutable being, and the Gita would have us live also in the immutable and the supreme. In the changing march of time, and the Gita would have us live in the eternal. Or if these higher things are now beginning to be vaguely envisaged, it is only to make them subservient to man and society. Again, human is God. God is there, but he can have a little place, a little corner, maybe a little door, cupboard where I can keep God. But God is everywhere. How can you throw him out? He is everywhere. He will declare in one way or the other. So, saying that, but God and spirituality exist in their own right and not as adjuncts. And in practice, the lower in us must learn to exist for the higher. Lower is the human, all our human ways. Higher is the divine. Of course, the divine is within us. But the higher is the divine, and to the divine self, we have to subordinate the lower. In order that the higher also may in us consciously exist for the lower, to draw it nearer to its own altitudes. Therefore, it is a mistake to interpret the Gita from the standpoint of the mentality of today and force it to teach us the disinterested performance of duty as the highest and all-sufficient law. I can take another example from Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo has written the human cycle, human unity, war, self-determination. Many things, a beautiful book. So human unity, word people catch. So they want to create human unity by human ways. But Sri Aurobindo says in the ideal of human unity, it can only be created on the basis of the divine self. You can have collective harmony only if its members live in union with the mother. When Nalinda asked Sri Aurobindo, what is the secret of collective harmony? He said, living in the mother. Meaning thereby, if there is disharmony, it means we have stopped living in the mother. So what is the way? To go back to this original teaching and live in the mother. If you live in the mother, everything else will come. Even if a handful of people really live in the mother. So Sri Aurobindo very clearly removes. And then he says something very interesting. Last line on page 32. In human life, some sort of a clash arises fairly often. As for instance, between domestic duties and the call of the country or the cause, or between the claim of the country and the good of humanity, or some larger religious or moral principle. So all this, these clashes take on, but what is the highest for which we should be ready to renounce all other duties? And that he says on next page, last line, page 33, last line in that para which is continuing. The call of God is imperative and cannot be weighed against any other considerations. And then of course, she takes up the more difficult problem. Call of God is fine. But what if I am called upon to do something which is gory, which is killing, act of killing, murder? How can I do this? Because call of God is fine, but God will want us to do nice things, sweet things. He will ask us to talk sweetly, nicely, considerately. That's how somebody told the mother that, Mother, I am ready to follow God's command, but I'll never lift a sword against anyone because I know that God will never ask me to do it. And the mother asked him, how do you know that? How do you know that? The Gita is precisely about a terrible action. We cannot imagine a more terrible action. Should one do it if such be the will of the Lord? So the Gita will answer. So page 33, next the para that starts. But here there is this further difficulty that the action which Arjun must do is one from which his moral sense recoils. It is his duty to fight, you say, but that duty has now become to his mind a terrible sin. God, that is going to create division, that is going to create problems. confusion. Any war is going to be take its toll. How does it help him to solve his difficulties? To tell him that he must do his duty disinterestedly, dispassionately? He will want to know which is his duty or how it can be his duty to destroy in a sanguinary massacre his kin, his race and his country. He is told that he has right on his side, but that does not and cannot satisfy him, because his very point is that the justice of his legal claim does not justify him in supporting it by a pitiless massacre destructive to the future of his nation. Now you see, these conflicts are going on everywhere. Whether you take the Middle East, whether you take Russia, Ukraine, this conflict is going on. What should mankind do? Which side it should take? These are there. During Second World War, Sri Aurobindo very clearly said, we should be on the side of the Allies. Despite the fact that the Britishers were inimical to Indians. Yet he said, why? Because he said, this is the side which God wants to win. Because through this victory, at least the path of evolution will be open. But if you take the side of Hitler and his like, it will block the way for 10,000 years. Now, see, it sounds very strange. Even a man like Subhash Chandra Bose, he had gone and shook hands with Hitler. Rabindranath Tagore had gone all the way and, you know, praised Mussolini like anything. Because it's not about, you have to see what is God's will in a given situation. And how to know it, the Gita is the answer towards that. Undoubtedly, the Gita does, like the Upanishads, teach the equality which rises above sin and virtue, beyond good and evil, but only as a part of the Brahmic consciousness and not for the man who is on the path and for the man who is on the path and advanced enough to fulfill the supreme rule. It does not preach indifference to good and evil for the ordinary life of man. It is about rising above morality, not falling below it. So this is the other problem. People say, oh, the Gita says there is no good and evil are human conceptions, good and sin. Therefore, I can murder with impunity, I can kill with impunity, because ultimately it is God who is doing it. This is another part. It's meant for those who want to arrive at God realization. I would say the same is true of Sri Aurobindo's teaching, so much more. That's why Sri Aurobindo and the mother were never keen on getting a horde of people. They said few who are ready for the yoga is much better, and sometimes to want to attract numbers can be very dangerous to a true authentic movement. Because you may have plenty, but there will be a great dilution. People have to come on their own. Because it's yoga, it's not filling human dashes filled with human beings. Human beings who are not ready for the yoga, if they join a movement, they will invariably destroy it. They don't understand yoga, they don't know God, or they have some religious idea. And if people come with a religious idea, not the God state, they will bring their own ideas, own conceptions. And there would be a problem. So, Sri Aurobindo speaks about duty and all that. And then, next page, 35. There are in the world, in fact, two different laws of conduct, each valid in its own plane, the rule principally dependent on external status, and the rule independent of status and entirely dependent on the thought and conscience. The Gita does not teach us to subordinate the higher plane to the lower. So, meaning thereby, if your inner thought and conscience is awakened, that is higher than merely being driven by a social or a collective convention. But equally, even this inner conscience, when it is awakened, this has to be subordinated to the divine impulsion and the divine will. So the next para, the Gita can only be understood like any other great work of the kind by studying it in its entirety and as a developing argument. But the modern interpreters, starting from the great writer Bankim Chandra Chatterjee, who first gave to the Gita this new sense of a gospel of duty, have laid an almost exclusive stress on the first three or four chapters And in those on the idea of equality, on the expression kartavyam karma, the work that is to be done, which they render by duty, and on the phrase, thou hast a right to action, but none to the fruits of action. So he says, this is not the Mahavakya of the Gita. It develops its argument. You will see it. For instance, the second chapter will say, Krishna telling Arjun, what does it matter? Fight this battle. This is just battle. If you fall, at least you will have a name that you fought for the good cause. And if you win, you enjoy the kingdom. Now somebody may take this and say, see, Gita is asking us to enjoy the kingdom and fight for it because we are legally correct. He says, no, that's the beginning. It's better to fight for the just cause than simply to lay down arms because you are in a state of despair and confusion. But he says it develops it and takes us to many more things which we must see in totality. So there he takes up this phrase, right to action. You have a right to action, not to the fruits. So the question is, how do I choose my action? Right to action may mean that I'll choose it according to whatever is the prevalent either viewpoints or according to the three gunas of Prakriti. So he says that not to be bound by Prakriti, but Gita wants us to rise higher. So we'll read page 36 down below. For the Gita goes on to affirm emphatically that the man is not the doer of the action. It is Prakriti, it is nature, it is the great force with its three modes of action that works through him, and he must learn to see that it is not he who does the work. Therefore, the right to action is an idea which is only valid so long as we are still under the illusion of being the doer. So you start with this, that I have a right to action, I make my choices and surrender the result to God. But there must come a time when I must discover God impulsion within me. And the action should be completely a transparent, a flawless flowing from the divine will into the bodies, into the mind, into our life, and therefore it should become a perfect action. So right to action itself, based on what? By determinisms of Prakriti, a sattvic man will like to act in a righteousness, a rajasic man may be driven by his ambition, tamasic man driven by his mechanical sense of things. Now, right to action would mean he should continue doing that and don't worry about the results. Shivindu is saying, no, that is a beginning, not the culmination of the Gita. So, this is where he is one-to-one, taking us step by step. Page 37. He says this, the disciple has to rise beyond this force, that is Prakriti, and its three modes or gunas. He has to become Trigunatit. Trigunatit bhava sabhyasachi. So Trigunas, we know the sattvic mode, where we are moved by the sense of righteousness, right and wrong. People who live only for mental ideas and ideals, they cannot take to spiritual life. It's so difficult. Sri Ramakrishna used to say that there are three kinds of bonds. This one is the iron bond, tamas, mechanical, habitually, where whatever you are doing, you continue doing it every day. You say, I don't bother about the fruits. Some people take to that mode, and it is very easy to fall into that in a apparently spiritual religious organization, because you are provided for. So everything is provided for you. So you just do impartially, indifferently, oh, this is my job, so you go there and do it. And you are very happy that I have renounced the fruits of the action. Naturally, there are no fruits which are going to come, except subtle fruits perhaps. So this is one kind of mode. Second is rajasic man, who pushes. He is pushed by his ambition and desires and gives it a coloring of God. I am doing it for the sake of God. Again, in a religious spiritual organization, it may happen that one may believe that anything that I am doing is God's work. But it may be that one is driven by ambition and desire. Swami Vivekananda at one point toward the last bit of his life says, I feel all that I have done has been moved by ambition. And when this letter was shown to Sri Aurobindo, he says, well, there may be a truth in it. Now we can imagine, and wow, someone of his caliber. And yet one has to act. So see, the line is so thin, so subtle, So one has to be very sure inside that one is impelled by the divine will. Equally, this second chain, Rajasic chain, Sri Ramakrishna said, is the silver chain. So iron chain is difficult to break, but people want it to be removed because it's of no value. The silver chain is easy to remove and everybody is happy to remove it. But the golden chain is the sense of self-righteousness. According to our own moral, social, religious conceptions, we want to act according to that and see the world driven by that. But the beauty is, or the challenge of this world is, God does not act according to any of these and yet uses all of them. If he was to act purely on the basis of righteousness, all the people who are filling their income tax should be the best. They too suffer. All the people who are doing good, they too go through pain and suffering. So where is justice? People often ask. Somebody asked me the other day, I have been doing work in the office conscientiously, but somebody else who just simply does faki, you know what is faki, somehow, but he impresses the boss, they get the promotion. So why does God do it like that? I said, see, God doesn't see and value the way we see and value. So to those who seek money, he gives them money. Those who seek power, he gives them power. Those who seek a seat in the hall of fame, they give him seat in the hall of fame. But to those who seek God, he gives himself. And then maybe all the rest. But all the rest should be subordinated to the primary aspiration of seeking the divine. Minus this, whatever you may do, you may reach a point, but you will realize, because without God, your heart will be an abyss. It will be full of despair. You will cry. You will be unhappy. Everything you will have, but because God is missing. That's why the Gita is telling us something much higher. So he asks us to be Trigunatheet. Not to her has he to surrender his action. Her means nature. Whatever way nature drives me, because God is doing all, I will do it. But I won't have a right to, I will not have a claim to fruits. He says, no. That means we have surrendered to nature. People often ask, surrender is so difficult. But we are all the time surrendering ourselves. We are surrendering to an idea, an ideology, to this friend, that person, that family. We are surrendering all the time. But surrender to the divine, what does it mean? So he says, reposing his mind and understanding, heart and will in him with self-knowledge and understanding. With self-knowledge, with God knowledge, with world knowledge, with a perfect equality, a perfect devotion, an absolute self-giving, he has to do the works. He has to do works as an offering to the master of all self-energizings and all sacrifice. And there comes that great phrase of the mother, we are not here to please others. We are not here to please ourselves. We are here to please the Lord. She said something more personal, which I love. We are not here to please others. We are not here to please ourselves. We are here to please Sri Aurobindo. So beautiful. That's all we are here. And we may say as her children, we are not here to please others. We are not here to please ourselves. We are here to please the mother. Fulfill what she wants and feel her will in us. And then Sri Aurobindo takes us to the Mahavakya. Page 37. What the great, the supreme word of the Gita is, it's Mahavakya. Because people have said the Mahavakya is Nishkam Karma, right to action and desireless. We have not to seek, for the Gita itself declares it is its last utterance. So Gita gives three Mahavakyas. And the last it says that it is the greatest of secret that I am revealing to you. The highest secret. And what is that highest secret? The Mahavakya. The crowning note of the great diapason. With the Lord in thy heart, take refuge with all thy being. By his grace, thou shalt attain to the supreme peace and the eternal status. Beautiful it is. Man bana bhava mad bhakta madhyaji man namaskuru. Aham tva sarva pape pyo mukshishami masucha. After those. Sarvadharman parityajya mamekam sharanam raja. Become my minded, devoted to me. To me do sacrifice and adoration. Infallibly thou shalt come to me. for dear to me art thou. That's the only thing that a God seeker seeks. Closeness to the divine. Oneness with the divine. Beautifully, yesterday I had a conversation. Somebody said this, and that line went so deep. It was like nectar. That what is the principle that operates in the ashram? It's not about doing big things, small things. Whatever you are doing is there is a worship. And the only object of doing, very beautifully said, it's not about success, recognition. It's about growing closeness to the mother. The only criteria, am I growing close to the mother? Good. There is a small little story of, I think it was Amal Kiran, he had done some painting and taken to the mother, and the mother saw one part and said, this part has been done very well. And he said, I felt such a fool because that was the only time I was remembering and offering to her. And then the rest of it was done. So the only thing that matters ultimately is to grow close, intimate, and ultimately one with the mother. The sign of that will be self-existent peace and bliss. Complete faith. Absolute absence of fear of any kind. Because the touch of the divine liberates us from all fear. Fear, shame, guilt, and 100 things we can add to that. All the bandhans. You'll be freed from desire. You won't need anything because the divine presence will fill all the gaps. This is the thing we are seeking. People may like it, not like it. People may appreciate, not appreciate. The work may continue or it may stop. Doesn't matter. None of this really matters. So that's where Sri Aurobindo takes us. The argument of the Gita resolves itself into three great steps by which action rises out of the human into the divine plane, leaving the bondage of the lower for the liberty of a higher law. First, by the renunciation of desire and a perfect equality, works have to be done as a sacrifice by man as the doer. A sacrifice to a deity who is the supreme and only self, by him not yet realized in his own being. We may not have realized the mother, we may not understand. Do it as an offering to her. People may understand, not understand, things may work out, they may not work out, you may have success, you may have failure. Not that you have to say, I don't care how I do, because you have to do the work beautifully. Because it is your worship, it's your sacrifice to the divine. With full concentration on the divine. What may come of it? Fine. See how Sri Aurobindo could leave the field where everybody, you know, had seen him as the rising star. Even they sought him that, oh, why have you gone away? Please come and take the presidentship of the Congress. And at the command, he leaves it. That is the approach. If needed to leave, if that's how things, it doesn't mean we should rush to leave and throw away things. But if such be the situation, if nothing is there, if he gives us nothing but a penny to thrive only for the next meal. That's how Sri Aurobindo's life. His life is a living example. He would say that I don't know whether I'll have the next meal or not. And he says it humorously. God has contracted a bad habit. I know he will provide. But at the last moment, he says bad habit. With that faith that if I am living for the divine, he will take care. How he will take care? So then there are no worries, anxiety, because it is his work. It is not my work that I am doing. Of course, one should do whatever one needs to do. And yet, it is his work in the last analysis. Sri Aurobindo was, he would say, even ashram, he would not be attached to anything when you look at it. In fact, at one point he says, do you think the mother's purpose of embodiment is only to have an institution called the ashram? Nothing. When somebody wanted to take over the ashram, who somebody? Sri Aurobindo's own nephew. That now everything is in Sri Aurobindo's name. He is no more after 50, 51. Therefore, legally it should come to me. So people were very scared. They went to mother. Nalnida goes to mother. Mother, he has written this. Mother says, tell him to come and take over. That's it. He was so shaken by this. Tell him to come and take over. Because you and the divine is everywhere. under all circumstances, in everything. If this is the approach, that my aspiration is to surrender myself completely to the divine, become one with the divine, then nobody and nothing can stop it except we ourselves. So this is the approach. And yet we must act, because it is through that, whatever action has come to us. This is the initial step. Secondly, not only the desire of the fruit, but the claim to be the doer of works has to be renounced in the realization of the self as the equal, the inactive, the immutable principle, and of all works as simply the operation of universal force. So people who keep these, what is called, biodata cards, and they're carrying in plenty, probably, you know, to give attention. I'm doing this, so and so is doing that. Sometimes you feel so foolish when there is only one doer. Very beautiful in one of the lines from Ram Prasad, he said, no, Dwijendralal Roy, Dilip Kumar Roy's father, grandfather. He writes, Tomar kormo, tumi koroma, loke bole kori ami. You are doing your work, people think I am doing. So this idea that I am the doer, first is desire, fruit, then the second is ego. I am the doer. I must do it because this is the work given to me. Okay, it was given to you. It may be taken away from you. What does it matter? He is the sole doer. He knows how to take care of things. It's his world after all. He has given. Yes, we should do. But tomorrow, it may be taken away. Indeed, nothing is given eternally, permanently. Only divine is given permanently. So it brings so much peace, you know, when we look at life like that. And lastly, the Supreme Self has to be seen as the Supreme Purusha governing this Prakriti, of whom the soul in nature is a partial manifestation, our individual soul, by whom all works are directed in a perfect transcendence through nature. To him, love and adoration and the sacrifice of works have to be offered. The whole being has to be surrendered to him. The goal is union with the divine. Here, there, anywhere, everywhere. Through this work, through that work, through whatever work he appointed in the heart as he directs us. I know of people in the ashram who once suddenly they were removed from a certain work. He is still alive, so I won't say the name. So he was sharing a story. He said, you know, suddenly was, and that time, the place where he was working, that place was doing so well. Actually, after his going away, it all deteriorated. But due to various reasons, he was taken off. So he felt within what he should do. He said, doesn't matter. I'll do my studies. He started studying this book, that book, all the books of Sri Aurobindo. Another second time, said, good. She has given me opportunity. After 1 year, suddenly they requested him, would you take classes in knowledge? Suddenly upgraded, so to say. So this is how we have to look at it. It's very simple, without all this strain, anxieties. What will happen? What will happen? Because lack of trust. So the first step is karma yoga, the selfless sacrifice of works. And here the Gita's insistence is on action. The second is jnana yoga, the self-realization and knowledge of the true nature of the self and the world. So karma, if done rightly, will lead us to knowledge. If it is not leading us to knowledge and we think we have to do something else, then something is amiss. If we do desireless action as a sacrifice to the divine, he will come close to us and knowledge will spring from within. It is inevitable. And here the insistence is on knowledge, but the sacrifice of works continues. You don't have to abandon work, but now with knowledge, the true knowledge. And the path of works becomes one with, but does not disappear into the path of knowledge. Works continue and the knowledge. Nirodha Sri Aurobindo, that can a person who has realized Sachidanand can continue to work? He said, good Lord, all that, what have I been teaching? My own life, he says, is an example. Can a person who has realized Sachidananda continue to work? Any work, whatever he may be. He will not regard it as menial. Look at Gangadharanji, such beautiful experiences mother has testified. But he used to wash initially, clean the toilets, and later on in the dining room. But if you look at his experience and how the closeness to the mother, he would live in a small little, in fact, darkish room below the staircase of one of the sadhaks. And the mother suddenly discovered, because she was going there and he was waiting outside with folded hands to greet her. And he said, What are you doing? He said, I live here, mother. Then she saw and scolded Amritdha. This is how Amritdha was a joy, her child. So he wanted to change. No, mother, please don't do that. I'm very happy here. Very happy. Dark, nothing, because it's a very small little room. But he had realized that the mother. There are so many examples in our own tradition. So we should not forget this is the goal. Then heart is at peace and ease. So knowledge. The last step is bhakti yoga. Adoration and seeking of the Supreme Self as the divine being. And here the insistence is on devotion. But the knowledge is not subordinated, only raised, vitalized and fulfilled. And still the sacrifice of works continues. The double path becomes the triune way of knowledge, works and devotion. And the fruit of the sacrifice, the one fruit still placed before the seeker, is attained. What is that fruit for which we are working? In Auroville, Ashram, here, there, everywhere. What is that fruit? Union with the divine being and oneness with the supreme divine nature. That is the goal of all action. Not success in the worldly sense, not this, that, recognition, fulfillment of ambition. No. Goal is union with the divine being and oneness with the supreme divine nature. So we'll stop here and next time we'll continue.